And next week we don't have a class because of Thanksgiving. But today is November 17th, Thursday morning. And we're here in our class on theodicy in rabbinic writings. Let me do a little bit of review after I put on the board a concept that I think has to be clarified. Let's make sure we remember the difference between punishment and atonement.
Big difference.
Anyone have the custom in their lives or have heard of this custom from a mother or grandmother, a great-grandmother, that when something breaks, like a plate or a glass, or something bad happens, they say, kapara?
I thought you do that with a chicken. No, that's kapara.
No, that's the same word, you're right.
It is, yeah.
And I remember that my mother-in-law would say kapara if anything bad happened. And kapara means actually atonement. So let's try and clarify. When we talk about punishment, and I'm of course talking here about theology, about divine punishment, it means that you are being given bad because you deserve it, because of something you did in the past that deserves punishment, deserves suffering, deserves pain. It's easy to understand. Now, what is atonement? Atonement is very similar but very different. Atonement is when something bad happens as a result of, in the wake of, because of bad you've done in the past, but this bad that happens, this suffering, this pain, is not giving you deserve. It's not tit for tat. It's rather, and I'll use a phrase we all recognize, it's rather burning off the sin on your slate so you won't have to be punished for it.
Okay, so
you won't have to be punished for it.
Punishment is beat up.
That's a very good. Let's put what Chip just said on the board. Punishment, in theory, at least, is measure for measure. Measure for measure, you get what you deserve. Whereas atonement is giving you less than you deserve, so you won't have to get what you deserve. Okay. Right, that's atonement.
So that's a different definition. I'm not arguing with it. It's a different definition of atonement than what we think of as tshuva.
Yeah.
Oh, nothing to do with tshuva at all. Nothing to do with the repentance. But you can think of Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, in the following terms. That we make ourselves suffer. Right, we fast, we afflict ourselves. The mitzvah on the day of Yom Kippur is to afflict yourselves. V'nitav et nafshotechem, in order to get God, as it were, to wipe away our sins. That's atonement. It's a little bit of suffering to wipe away the sins so you won't have to be punished.
What is there a distinction there as to who is doing it? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is punishment is God causing it to happen to you, and atonement is your causing.
No, that's not necessarily, that's not the essential distinction. Atonement could be God making a little bit of suffering your life, not as punishment, but rather to burn the sin off the slate so he won't have to punish you.
Okay.
The Day of Atonement has a certain degree of self-affliction, right? But it's the command. Yeah. Right? God commands us to afflict ourselves, as it were, in order to burn off the sin from the slate.
Yeah, you just touched on something that bothers the rabbis. Okay? That the Day of Atonement is for God to wipe away our sins against God. All right? So if I don't observe kashrut, if say I don't observe kashrut, which is definitely a sin against God, not against man, Does God then excuse me for that?
Does God on Yom Kippur wipe away
that's
slate? Yes. But let's not talk about Yom Kippur. We just use that as an example.
Okay.
To understand the difference between punishment and atonement. Now, let's take these two categories and fit them into frameworks we've developed in the past in this room. We've talked about reactive divine punishment. I take it back. Reactive divine providence and proactive divine providence. Reactive meaning God's reaction to the past, and proactive meaning God aiming towards a goal in the future. Right? That we've said many times. So now, clearly, punishment falls under what? Reactive or proactive?
Reactive.
Reactive, that's clear. But atonement might confuse us as to where to put it. Is it reactive or is it proactive? What do you say?
Well, if its purpose is to wipe the slate clean, if its purpose is not to punish but to wipe the slate clean, I could argue it's proactive.
Yes, you can. In other words, although atonement is functioning vis-a-vis the past, its purpose is vis-a-vis the future.
So it could be both.
It's a combination of both, certainly. But what's important to realize is that atonement has an element of proactive divine providence. God is doing something for the purpose of the future. Again, it's true that what he's doing has an eye towards the past, but its purpose is for the future. Okay? I think that's important. Now, next stage, we have in this room many times used the expression the burn-off theory. But I think that I've less used the expression atonement. So I just want us to understand that the burn-off theory is directly related to atonement. Right? Let's remind ourselves. The burn-off theory says that I'm a righteous person and God wants to reward me. So what does he do? He gives me lots of suffering. Right? Well, how does that make any sense? Because we said there's no tzaddik ba'aretz. There's no righteous person on earth without sin at all. Everyone has a little bit. So I'm a righteous person, and that God really, really loves me. And he wants to reward me in the next world. So what does he do? He gives me suffering in this world to burn off the little bit of sin I have on my ledger, so he'll be able to completely and absolutely reward me in the next world. That was the burn-off theory we saw developed in many, many different Talmudic passages. And at this point, I'm doing a little bit of tshuva. I'm sorry that I didn't mention the word atonement when we learned that, right? Because that's really about atonement. The burn-off theory is a use of the idea of atonement. God is causing me to suffer as atonement for those few sins I have for the purpose of rewarding me in the future. So I'm just putting things here in perspective. Okay. Now, with that, with those categories in mind, let's just very briefly remember a few things that we said last week. Last week, I don't mean 7 days ago, I mean the week before that, because 7 days ago, of course, Rabbi Zef was here teaching a class in my absence. In the course of the past few weeks, looking at the Talmudic passages, we've been moving from passages that completely and absolutely talk about punishment, that talk about reactive divine providence, and moving to those passages that begin to introduce the idea of proactive divine providence. And we've seen the burn-off theory in that context, right? The atonement theory, that I'm suffering not because God's punishing me for the past, but because he's preparing a better future for me. So in that context, we then saw a passage from, for example, Tractate Sanhedrin, page 101a, and I'm not going to tell you exactly where it is because I'm not exactly sure what the pagination is there. But in any case, Rabbi Eliezer was sick, and his disciples came in to visit him, and Rabbi Akiva was happy to see his master suffering. Why was Rabbi Akiva, the eternal optimist, happy this time also? Because he said, I'm so happy that your sins are being atoned for, because now you'll be rewarded in the future world. And that again was our example of the burn-off theory. And then there was a second version of the same story, again in Tractate Sanhedrin 101a, in which the rabbis went in to visit Rabbi Eliezer, who was sick, and they were all crying over his terrible pain. Rabbi Akiva was happy to see again his master suffering. And the phrase that Rabbi Akiva used was, suffering is beloved. Havivin Yisurin, suffering is beloved. We had that on the board last time. Suffering is beloved. In other words, it's not punishment, it's not something bad, it's something good. And Rabbi Akiva didn't define there why is it good. And we said that it might be, it's good because it's atonement. Could be the same idea that Rabbi Akiva mentioned before. It's atonement, it's the burn-off. Although it might be something else also, it doesn't say. Suffering is beloved, Havivin Yisurin. Proactive divine providence. And then we saw the passage from Shabbat, the next passage, Shabbat 55a in the Babylonian Talmud, where we learned as a final conclusion in that passage that there is such a thing as suffering without sin. That's not a positive statement. Why do you suffer? It's a negative statement that you're not necessarily suffering because of sin. And that, of course, opens the door to, again, proactive divine providence. Perhaps you're suffering because God has a purpose for the future, not necessarily because you did anything wrong. And then we went on to Tractate Brachot 60, page 60.
Are we on 60B?
That's it.
Okay.
Tractate Brachot, page 60B, in which we saw that Rabbi Akiva was encamped, if you remember, outside of a city because he wanted to lodge there and they didn't have any place for him. And while he was lodged outside of the city, a wind came and blew at his lantern and a lion came and ate his cock. And in the middle of the night, after that happened, bandits came and attacked the city and took all the inhabitants captive. And the bandits didn't see Rabbi Akiva in the field because his lantern had gone out and his cock was dead. Rabbi Akiva woke up and said, wow, everything that God does has a purpose. Kol derachmana, all that God does, letav asa, for the good he does.
Except for the people in the city.
Right, right.
I mean...
Right. But the point was, Rabbi Akiva understood that that which had happened to him at night,
yeah, that's a
which could have been interpreted as bad, was really for the good.
For Akiva's good.
For Akiva's good.
That was, is that a tale or was that a coup?
It's presented as if it really happened.
As if it really happened. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And Rabbi Akiva always said, everything that God does, for the good he does.
Would he have said it if he was destroyed partially?
So we're going to get to that in another few seconds. So let's just put this in perspective. What Rabbi Akiva is saying is, I think, the following. If you look at God's providence only reactively, then you don't understand why these bad things happened to me, Rabbi Akiva. What did I do to deserve my lamp going out and my cock being eaten by wild animals? What did I do to deserve that? However, if you look at it in a broader perspective, you understand that it does make sense, because it's not a matter of reactive divine providence, it's a matter of proactive divine providence. God did those things to me that appeared to be negative for a positive purpose, to save me from the bandits. Now, of course, bringing up what everyone just said, what about the people in the city? You have to add, I think, into this mix. You have to add into the proactive, you also have to add reactive. Because why did Rabbi Akiva deserve to have such bad things happen to him? These bad things, in quote, that were good. Probably because he deserved it, he would say. In other words, He got the proactive for a reactive reason. And then about the city, well, what did the city deserve to be carried off by bandits? You'd have to say that's reactive divine providence. So we're not abandoning the idea of reactive divine providence. We're just saying that Rabbi Akiva is adding on its back this idea of proactive.
In other words, one act can have multiple purposes.
So Rabbi Akiva is providing us a new, a larger perspective, just like Rabbi Akiva told us that suffering is beloved. It's the same type of proactive vision of things. Okay, and then the next source we had seen was from Midrash Shira Shirim Rabba, and I don't think we have a need to mention that in the review. So we'll go on to the source that we just began to scratch the surface of last time, which is Tractate Brachot, page 5A to 5B, and that'll take our whole class today, most probably. So Joe, if you want to look on with someone on your left or your right. So you can't find Brachot page 5A?
5A and 5B.
Yeah.
A/B. Starts with Rava, some say.
It's on the second to the last sheaf of paper, leaf of the last week's hand, 2 weeks ago handout.
Is it among those that are stapled together?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Second to the last.
The very top left is Rabbi Yohan said to him.
Brachot, page 5A to 5B.
Okay, we have it here.
It's on this one. The one that starts
circle on
the top
left. Well,
look on. Look on
with Jay.
Rava, some say, Rav Chista says, if a man sees painful sufferings visit him, let him examine his conduct. For it is said, let us search and try our ways and return unto the Lord. So that's simple, right? The intuitive reaction to suffering is, I must have done something wrong, reactive divine providence, I'm being punished, search out our ways and see what we did wrong and return to the Lord. Fine. If he examines and finds nothing objectionable, let him attribute it to the neglect of the study of the Torah, for it is said, happy is the man whom thou chastenest, O Lord, and teachest out of the law. So when suffering comes, it has to do with teaching out of the law. In other words, if you can't find anything you did wrong, well, certainly you wasted 5 minutes watching Law and Order when you could have been learning Torah. And that's a serious sin, so that must be the source of what's going on wrong in your life. Now, there are those who might say that Law and Order is learning Torah, because there's some important messages there. But putting that aside, straightforwardly, everyone suffers from the sin of bitul Torah, of not spending all their time learning Torah. And as we know, that mitzvah is yomam v'laylas, day and night. You're supposed to learn Torah every single moment.
What do the rabbis say when these horrible things happen to children? They haven't sinned.
Again, we're studying the text and we're not studying truth, right? Let's see what the texts say. And when we see what the texts say, we can later grapple and see how that applies to our own lives. Many things we've seen cannot answer your question. A few of them, I think, relate to the question. But that's not for now. If he did attribute it thus and still did not find this to be the cause, if you can't find any sin you did, and you cannot find any moment that you didn't learn Torah when you could have, let him be sure that these chastenings are of love, that these are Yisurin Shel Ahava. And I'll put that on the board. I'll call it Suffering of Love. Suffering of Love. Which might be very similar to, if not the same thing, as the previous phrase we have there on the board, suffering is beloved, Havivin Yisurin, that Rabbi Akiva said, one should love suffering. Suffering is of love. And here we have suffering of love, Yisurin Shel Ahava. Now, if you can't find anything you did wrong that would justify what's happening to you, then it can't be punishment. It just can't be. It must be something else. It must be the chastenings of love. And please see, this is parallel to everything we've been seeing for the past weeks that I reviewed for the past 15 minutes. For example, that passage that it said that, how did we exactly phrase it? In Shabbat 55b, we had said that not all suffering is punishment, or there is suffering without punishment, without sin. The same thing again. The first intuition is that suffering is a reaction to sin, and you should live your life like that. If something happens, check out what you did wrong. But there's a possibility that you didn't do anything wrong that justifies what's happening to you. There is another direction. There is suffering without sin, and here it's called suffering of love. But what is that exactly? Perhaps it's only atonement. Perhaps that's what suffering of love is, just atonement. In other words, everyone sins. It's just that you didn't find sin that justifies the suffering that you're going through. So perhaps it's not punishment. Perhaps it's not measure for measure. Perhaps there's nothing you did wrong that would justify it. Rather, it's atonement. In other words, it's because of some sin, but it's not punishment for the sin. It's rather
burn off.
It's rather to give you reward in the future. And by the way, as we read through this passage, we'll see that there are certainly signs in the coming lines that point to that. And I would like to put this in the following framework. To say that suffering of love, which is a concept we'll see again and again and again, is a matter of atonement, I'm going to call that the minimalist way of looking at things. Because there are larger, more expansive, and to my mind, more meaningful ways of interpreting suffering of love, but that's the minimalistic. That's the one that still ties it to some sin in the past. Again, it's not punishment for the sin, but it still ties it to some sin. That's a minimalistic understanding of suffering of love.
Back in the 50s or the 60s, there was an expression that was quite popular. It was called born to lose, I think. Mm-hmm. And the standard has been set so high, for example, in the example that's quoted here, that if you don't spend night and day and night studying the Torah, therein you incur some degree of sin. But that is an impossibility. I mean, in the literal sense, you cannot study day and night. Even if people provided you with a means of sustenance, you didn't have to work, people fed you and so forth, you could not stay up all night. I mean, this is an impossible standard. And it is so impossible that it's very illogical to base, I would think, a premise on the fact that a righteous person whose only sin might be even, that he didn't achieve the standard, is an element that goes toward what we're talking about. Of course, that is punishment for this, quote, sin. Mm-hmm. So I think this is shaky in its logical basis if, in fact, you use this type of a standard that no one, in other words, you were born to lose.
So I guess I should apologize for my whimsical exaggeration.
No, I think it's what it says.
Well, bitul Torah, the neglect of Torah study, is discussed in many, many places in the Talmud. There are different opinions, but what's clear is that you're allowed to sleep. You're allowed to eat. Some even say you're allowed to work for a living. Right? That's an argument between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Yishmael, which we once talked about. But you're allowed to eat, you're allowed to sleep, you're allowed even, according to some, to work. But after we've talked all about that, the rest of the time, you should study. Now, of course, if you've studied 5 hours and you have to take a break in order to recharge your batteries, you can take the break also. The Rambam even says you can go on vacation sometimes because you have to recharge your batteries. You have to go to the museum. You have to go to Turkey. You have to go to the museum. The Rambam talks about going to museums to recharge your spiritual batteries. But after you've done all that, you're not allowed to sometimes just twiddle your thumbs and waste your time. So
you can't watch the World Series.
I don't think you can watch the World Series unless you claim that you need sometimes a break to recharge your spiritual batteries. As the Rambam puts it, a kol l'shem shamayim, everything should be this for the sake of heaven. And if you can justify, you know, gourmet cooking and playing tennis and the World Series, everything, if you can justify it, I did this in order to regain my health or to keep healthy so that I can serve God, and I did this in order to recharge my spiritual batteries so I can serve God, and I did this in order, then it could turn out that if you've done everything in a well-thought-out fashion, that you really only learned to an hour a day, but that was the purpose that everything else was moving towards, then it's okay.
Rabbi,
but you have to make the cheshbon, you have to make the accounting. Says the Rambam.
If that were true for the righteous person, just to follow this up, then it wouldn't be a basis for the argument that the punishment was the cause of this type of infraction for the righteous sage.
No, it still would be, because you perhaps didn't make the proper accounting, or you wasted 5 minutes when you should have been learning. Instead, you saw 5 extra minutes of the World Series, or perhaps you should have been learning during the commercials, but instead you watched the commercials. But anyway, we're getting off topic a little bit.
You mentioned several classes ago that Judaism believes in the golden mean and the happy medium, a balance between extremes. But this seems to be in an extreme, though, instead of a balance.
The Rambam says this is the balance.
This is the balance.
This reminds me of an abusive husband who loves his wife to death.
No, but the Rambam does say 3 hours a day for working and 5 the rest of the time for Talmud and the rest of the time for studying Torah.
Yes, he does. Someone's calling me from Israel for the past 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, please answer.
Hello.
I think
both of them are physicians.
Hello.
The Rambam.
Call back.
Find out who. Go call
if they
back.
Call again, we'll
it
see.
It could be family. Why don't you make that a priority?
Yes, if someone calls again.
You can take a break from studying Torah.
Yeah,
talk
yeah. Okay.
Yes, that's
family is priority.
If they call again, I will take the call.
Question on back on the subject.
It doesn't say who's calling.
Calling from Israel is important.
Doesn't say who's calling. It could be they're calling from the phone company to offer me a new plan.
Question. Okay, yes. We're talking about atonement, where I don't remember the exact words, but it's suffering without sin. But what am I burning off if it's not anticipation? If it's not sin of the past,
right,
and it's anticipated sin of the future.
Right. I struggled with that. And I think that the answer is that when they say that there's no, that there is suffering without sin, I think that at least what some of the commentaries are going to say is that it means that there's suffering that's not punishment for sin. But it doesn't mean there was no sin at all. Every human being has some sin.
Oh.
So we can still have the door open to say that there is atonement.
But
I think that's what many commentators will say.
Okay, maybe I'm getting a little bit too specific here, because I'm visualizing, here I am, here's the past, and here's the future. I have sinned in the past, and now I have atonement, which is, pardon the terminology, punishment that's disproportionate to the amount of sin, so therefore it is considered to be burn off for taking care of me in the future.
Right.
But if it's taking care of me in the future, then, and it's disproportionate, then I'm on the positive side. So does that mean I'm going to sin in the future?
No, it means
to break
that,
even.
No, it means you'll get a great, great reward in the future, because now God owes you something.
Future is after you've died.
Got a credit
it's
balance.
Not while you're
I got a credit balance.
Credit balance. Great.
Credit balance in heaven.
Okay.
I'm going to write that down. Credit balance.
If I have a choice, I'd like to break even now rather than a credit balance.
That's what many of the rabbis are about to say in this passage.
Okay.
Okay. So now we get to the next paragraph. After we've said there's such a thing as suffering of love without defining it. Rava, in the name of Rav Sahora, in the name of Rav Huna, says, if the Holy One, blessed be He, is pleased with a man, He crushes him with painful suffering. For it is said, and the Lord was pleased with him, hence He crushed him by disease. Which is a verse from Isaiah.
Right.
By the way, that verse is being understood here, not according to its simple meaning, but that's not our subject here. Actually, what they're quoting from is the chapter in Isaiah that's the suffering servant.
53,
where he's suffering for someone else's sins, but the rabbis are reinterpreting those verses for our purposes. It's not important. But what we have here is the same idea that if God loves you, He brings suffering upon you. And again, the suffering's not punishment. It's rather suffering of love. It's for a positive purpose. We haven't defined yet what the positive purpose is. Perhaps the minimalistic understanding is that it's atonement.
That's remarkable, because I'm sure that at the beginning, during the years when these people were living, there had to be a lot of disease, rampant disease. They didn't understand contagion, and then they had to find a reason, not an excuse, but a reason.
Right.
This was going on with so many scholars, or so many scholars were falling ill.
Yes, and especially the persecution of the scholars, that it's specifically the ones that God loves that are suffering.
They're talking about disease. I'm sticking with
mm-hmm. They did understand it because they sent lepers out?
No. Leprosy in Mitzrayim was something separate.
It's contagious.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they understood it as such.
They understood that you separate them.
But God can start it and stop it.
But they
didn't understand contagion.
It's
contagious.
Sure, they did. They understood as far as what you eat. Where do you think kosher came from? It came from disease prevention.
No, it didn't.
Not necessarily, but that's a whole different can of kosher worms.
Hey, what do you think?
I love Joe. He laughs at my jokes.
Okay,
let's go on, okay? Now, you might think that this is so, even if he did not accept them with love. Therefore, it is said, to see if his soul would offer itself in restitution, which again is a verse brought to prove that you have to accept your suffering with love. And it explains then the verse. And if he did accept them, accepted his suffering, what is his reward? He will see his seed prolong his days. Okay. And more than that, his knowledge of the Torah will endure with him, for it is said, the purpose of the Lord will prosper in his hand.
If this is so, then we shouldn't relieve suffering. We shouldn't heal suffering. Because that would be detrimental to the person's
Very good. Very good. And we'll have to talk about that, because we talked about it 2 weeks ago. We'll just have to remember what we said 2 weeks ago. That's a very good point. But first, let me just finish this unit that we just read. So we're talking here about the fact that suffering of love, to achieve its purpose, has to be accepted with... has to be accepted.
And if you don't?
Then it doesn't work its purpose. So now we have to ask ourselves, why, for suffering of love to work its magic, does it have to be accepted by the sufferer with a glad heart, with acceptance? Why is that? When I say why is that, I mean something further. I mean, what does that tell us? Can it help us to try and figure out what this suffering love is all about? So I want to offer the following possibility. And I heard this from a professor at Hebrew University called Moshe Halbertal, who is the son-in-law of David Hartman, Rabbi David Hartman. Moshe Halbertal, by the way, when I studied, the second time I studied Jewish philosophy at Hebrew University, was probably the most popular teacher on the whole faculty of the Department of Jewish Studies. A very, very amazing man who was once actually being groomed to be the next Gadol Hador, the next great Torah scholar of the generation, until he left yeshiva and went to academia. But that's a whole other story. So anyway, Moshe Halbertal suggested the following, that suffering of love, what is its purpose? What is it that God is giving? What's the present God is giving you? It's an opportunity to serve God in a totally disinterested fashion. Let me explain. Almost everything we do in life has a purpose. And that purpose is, in some sense, on some level, almost always a matter of self-interest. I eat for myself. I get married for myself. I have children for myself. You can always bring it back to self-interest. And to take it one step further, I keep Shabbat because I enjoy it. I keep kashrut because I think it's the right thing to do. And you can bring it all back to self-interest, that everything I do, there's almost no altruist acts that I do. And if everything I do, included in the sphere of religion, is basically for my own good, then hasn't religion lost its value? Isn't religion supposed to be serving God, not serving man? But if I'm just serving myself, so what's the purpose? Wait a second, Stephanie. What's the uplift? What's the holiness in Judaism? Now, Professor Yeshayahu Leibowitz used to go so far as to say that any mitzvah you do that you enjoy was an avera, was a transgression. Anything can get out of it. If you daven because it's meaningful, it wasn't davening. If you keep Shabbat because it's meaningful, it wasn't keeping Shabbat. If you keep kashrut because it makes sense to you, it's not religion. It's just serving man, not serving God. And you might as well just chuck it and just do self-serving things that are clearly self-serving. Even if we don't go so far, we can certainly understand that the opportunity to serve God when there's no self-interest involved is a tremendous uplift, a tremendous chance.
Go.
Hello. Hello, who am I? Yes, who am I speaking with?
Thank God it's my family.
I've been great, and actually it was very exciting to hear that you're coming to Dallas. I'm in the middle of a class right now, but I just took the phone call because I saw that from Israel someone's calling 5 or 6 times. So let us talk another hour and a half. Is that okay? 10 people listening to you. Great.
And God will get
yes, it is.
For that.
That's
Dallas.
Great. Okay, so I have to tell you this story. I got a phone call yesterday from a woman, I guess in her 60s, who's a doctor here in Dallas, who told me she just recently got married to a Torah scholar from Jerusalem, and that she's living in Dallas this year, he's living in Israel, he teaches at Bar Ilan, and then every once in a while he comes to visit her, and when he comes he wants something to do, he wants to teach Torah for no money, just wants to teach Torah. So what's his name? Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Pupko. She tells me the name. I studied with him 33 years ago. So we put two and two together. It turns out that in 1979, 1980, I studied with him in Yerushalayim. And I said, he's a character. He knows everything, and he can talk about anything, and he is a charismatic, flamboyant, iconoclast person, and he just called me 6 times from Israel.
He's coming to Dallas.
So he hasn't changed.
So he's done a mitzvah, and now that poor man is going to suffer.
And I hope indeed he gets to teach this class when he comes to Dallas.
Okay.
So now let's...
How long will he be here?
He'll be here for 3 weeks during the semester break at Bar Ilan in February. End of January, beginning of February. Anyway, that's Rav Pupko. Back to...
Pupko.
P-O-U-K-O. P-O-U-K-O.
Yeah, there used to be a Rabbi Pupko, very prominent in the RA, who was in the RCA, who was a rabbi in Chicago.
It's a famous rabbinic family. There are lots of Rabbi Pupkos. In any case, where were we now?
We were in the second last line.
Anyone under 50 in the room that remembers where we were?
You're saying about self-interest.
Self-interest.
What about flagellation? Because this starts bordering on, if the only way I can serve God is when I'm doing something that really I don't enjoy and I don't care for, why don't I just beat myself with chains and therefore I'm serving God because...
Very good.
That's my intention.
And the only answer I can think of in one foot is I don't have permission to damage my body because it belongs to God. But you're right, this approach could have brought us so far, which brings us to what Chip brought up a few minutes ago at Rabbi Akiva. Now remember, Rabbi Akiva has been one of the persons who's championing this idea of suffering of love or suffering as beloved. At the end of Tractate Brachot, there's the story of the death of Rabbi Akiva. He was martyred by the Romans as a very old man, who was probably in his 80s. And it says that his flesh was combed with combs of iron. And as he's being literally flayed and he's dying, he yells out to his students that all my life I've searched and waited for the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of loving God with all my might, with all my soul. And now the opportunity has come upon me and I won't grasp it. And he says, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. And on the word Echad, God is one, his soul departs. And it's as if Rabbi Akiva is enjoying or embracing the moment.
It's self-interest on his part.
Right, there's always that catch. Very good. Always that catch. But in any case, Rabbi Akiva is saying, I never had the opportunity to really, really demonstrate my love of God, because it always could have been understood as love of self. Everything I did for God, I was really doing for myself, because I enjoyed it, I got something out of it, I benefit from it. I got fame, I got students, I got simply self-satisfaction. Everything we do in life has a certain level, a certain degree of self-interest.
He called out to his students once again. He was himself happy.
That's what Chip just said.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Right. Very good, very good. Right. There's always that possibility of destroying any modicum of disinterested love of God.
Oh, God.
But this was the closest you could get. So if that is Rabbi Akiva at the end of his life, searching for the opportunity to serve God completely and absolutely out of love of the other, of God, and not love of self, then perhaps when we hear Rabbi Akiva talking about and teaching us about suffering of love, we should understand that that's what it's about. That when suffering comes upon me, I should embrace it, because it's an opportunity to serve God for no reason.
For no self-interested reason.
Right.
I like the Unitarian, to whom it may concern.
Right, and I just bring into it relationships between husband and wife, right? Like when I buy a pair of earrings for my wife, you say, very nice, you did something for your wife. It might not be. I did it for myself. It'll make her feel better. So
she'll like you more.
She'll like me better, right? It's all self-interest. But if I could give her a present that she won't know it's for me, right? That's disinterested love. If I can do something good for her that I will get nothing out of.
Send it anonymously.
Or perhaps even that I'll suffer for. To do something for her that I'll suffer for, that's perhaps the highest level of love. So therefore, if I'm suffering and life is extremely difficult, if under those circumstances I can serve God when I'm only getting out of it pain, and travail, that is the highest level. So here, God gives me an opportunity to serve Him out of love. Should I not embrace it? Should I not accept it? Should I not take it upon myself and utilize that opportunity? Perhaps that's what this Talmudic passage means when it says, number one, when it talks about suffering of love, and number two, when it says that suffering of love is not efficacious unless you embrace it. Right? Because if you don't... Now, from the matter that it says that it doesn't work unless you embrace it, perhaps from there we learn what it actually is. That was the suggestion of Moshe Halbertal.
See, Jim is beloved of God because I make him miserable enough.
I still say,
Jim.
I still say, Rabbi Kiva, have some of them suffered through a great deal of guilt at this point in time, for the simple reason that this was the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, when he was a prisoner of the Romans, and because of his actions, resulted in one of the greatest tragedies in Jewish history, the destruction of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, because 500,000 Jews died during that time period. It was due to a large degree because of his
really teed up for Romans.
Should I get peace?
What happened? That's what happened. So how can you even give any credibility to Rabbi Akiva? Because if you've got to put it in historical context about what he was saying at this point in time.
I don't know if I could know what's going through his mind on every level.
But he never expresses any regret over what he did at this point in time. And this,
not in the Talmudic sources.
The revolt was in 132 to 136 CE, if this was the time he was in prison.
He thought Bar Kokhba was a Messiah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
say that again, Mo. He was at Masada, didn't you?
He was a Messiah.
Rabbi Akiva thought he was the Messiah.
Rabbi Akiva said he was the Messiah.
Yeah, so I don't know what to do with that. Yes, I don't know how to parse it.
Rabbi Tafan said, Akiva's grass will grow on your jaws before the Messiah comes.
Martin.
No, I was looking at this part, and I'm wondering, were they trying to address suffering servant passages in Isaiah to give some meaning or some purpose? Because, of course, it says here, you know, the purpose of the order will prosper in the hands in spite of all this crushing of disease and everything and suffering. And what's interesting, it says he will see his seed prolong his days. That's sort of, you know, parts of Isaiah 53. So I'm wondering, are they trying to address that and to show, you know, relating back to, say, Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, that even though, you know, you're going to be crushing suffering, which in a way I keep, you know, then relating to like the Holocaust, trying to say, okay, there is a purpose that you're serving, you know, God, even though, you know, you're being crushed. And they're trying to, you know, I guess through here, respond to, of course, back then it was, you know, the suffering servant songs in Isaiah, to say that tribulation will come, but there is a purpose in spite of the suffering.
Yes, there's a purpose. That's what it's saying. There's a purpose. But it might be.
Do you think you're trying to address those passages in Isaiah? I mean,
that's a good question. I don't know.
They use them as proof texts, I guess.
Yeah. Is there here perhaps a comprehensive reinterpretation of Isaiah 53? That's a very good question that I don't know the answer to. Could be. They're all from the same chapter in Isaiah. You're right. Four or five verses.
Yeah, but they constantly take stuff out of context.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. I don't know if there was here a comprehensive reinterpretation of those verses. But anyway, so we have here the idea of suffering of love that has to be accepted, and I'm presenting the possibility that perhaps we can understand it as the opportunity for disinterested service of God. That's not the only way of parsing it. And perhaps it's simply a matter of atonement. Perhaps suffering of love is simply atonement. Okay, let's go on. Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi and Rav Acha Bar Hanina differ with regard to the following. The one says, chastenings of love, and that's again the suffering of love. Chastenings of love are such as do not involve the intermission of study of the Torah. In other words, suffering has to be such. For suffering to be classified as suffering of love, it can't be so bad that it prevents you from study. And it brings a verse, for it is said, happy is the man whom thou chastenest, the Lord, and teachest out of the law. And the other one said, chastenings of love are such as do not involve the intermission of prayer, that don't prevent you from praying. For it is said, blessed be God who hath not turned away my prayer, nor his mercy from. We don't have to understand how they're using the verses. It's not important for our purposes. So anyway, what we're basically being told is that for suffering to be suffering of love, it cannot be so terrible as to prevent me from prayer or study. Why? Well, if we go in the direction of what Moshe Halbertal said, it makes sense. Because if suffering of love is an opportunity to serve God in a totally disinterested fashion, then the suffering can't be so bad that it prevents me from serving God. Right? You know what I'm saying? Right? It has to be such that I continue to daven and continue to learn, but it hurts. And if I do those things, if I learn and I daven, when it still hurts, I'm doing it in a disinterested fashion. But if my disease is so terrible I can't learn or do any mitzvot, then how can it be suffering of love? And that, again, seems to go in the direction of what Moshe Halbertal said, that that's the definition of suffering of love, the opportunity to serve God in disinterested fashion.
That sort of discounts what the key to suffering was, doesn't it? Because during his suffering, there's no way he could have. He was, well, I guess he was still praying when he said it, because he said it was.
Right, that's the point there, that he was able to say Shema Yisrael when there was nothing would get out of it, because he was going to die in a few seconds, nothing get out of it, but he still did it. That is a suffering of love, and that is disinterested service of God.
It's a final self-love on his part, final self-love.
Chip is being sarcastic and cynical.
Yes, sir.
This is when he's in extreme pain. He's burning at that point.
Yeah.
But it's self-love because he wanted his people, his students, whoever was there, to remember what he said.
Okay, so you and Chip are in the same boat here. What can I say?
If he had kept his mouth shut, then it wouldn't have been self-love. Then Josephus wouldn't have told us.
No, then we wouldn't have had the story. Yeah.
Okay. We're going on.
I have a question. We're talking about trying to come up with some sort of a understanding of why bad things happen to good people. Mm-hmm. And we've taken it down a road so far that we have made it sound like if you're really, really good, you better have something bad happening to you. Otherwise, you're not really, really good. What? Is there an opposite viewpoint which says that it's good to not have bad things happen to you, and it's because God is saying it's okay, you're doing fine, keep it up?
Well, in the blessings in Deuteronomy, there are plenty of verses that say if you obey the commandments, you'll be blessed in the city, blessed in the country. Blessed.
Right, right. What you're saying is the obvious, straightforward, sensible way of looking at life from a religious perspective. But the problem was that the reality in which these rabbis lived didn't bear that out, because there was so much suffering, and especially suffering of the righteous.
Okay. Right? So putting it in context. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if we learn to solve all the suffering problems, which we have to a large degree, through there's no starvation, there's no early... the children survive, and we don't have the infant mortality, and we've cured so many diseases and everything like this, then does the whole approach be obsolete?
Of course, what you said only applies to a very small percent of the world's population.
Yeah. No, it's compared to
2/3 of the world's population does not still has all these same problems. The children die early.
The third world is much more righteous than we are.
Okay, but perhaps we could say, and I agree with Carol Ann that this applies only to a small, small, small percentage of the world's population.
But Jewish.
Perhaps we could say, that's a good point, we could say that our affluence and our progress in technology and medicine, etc., are really, to a certain degree, denying us a experience that can be life-changing and uplifting.
Early death?
And I'll be a little bit cynical, right? If I never get to suffer from cancer, and if I never get carpal tunnel syndrome, if I manage to stay out of the hospital my whole life, and I never lose my job, and I'm always fulfilled in my work,
and your children are always successful.
My children are successful.
Grandchildren,
right?
Right.
Then I've been denied an opportunity to grow, to become more nuanced in my and sensitive in my personality. I've been denied suffering of love. I've been denied the opportunity to serve God in a disinterested fashion. Yes,
that's
right.
You could always slit your wrists a little.
But
that's what Joe said earlier. Self-flagellation.
Right, remember.
On the other hand. And there always is another hand.
But you know, actually, Dorothy had a hand up. Yes.
God's way of rewarding man that he is unraveling all these good things.
100%, which is exactly what Joe said.
Yeah.
Can it just be straightforward that it's good not to suffer?
But
well,
you know, the truth of it is that no one gets away scot-free. I don't care who you are.
Never.
In your life, at some point, you suffer. It may be minor, it may be major. I don't know anyone who's gotten through life without some suffering along the way.
Yeah.
So, even the people who have health and prosperity and the children are doing well, something happens.
Absolutely.
To give you a knock in the head.
Yeah.
All right, here's another rationale.
Well, I think Mo was waiting in line.
I think part of our discussion is missing the intent of these rabbis. And the question is, how do we best serve God? And is God doing these things to us, either in the sense, I'm talking about the atonement portion now. Is God doing this to us so that we will have a better life in the life to come? Or is this, in other words, a gift from God in order to bring us closer to Him?
In this world.
In this world.
Yeah.
Right, and suffering of love could be either of those two. It's not clear.
Yeah. They're not asking questions like, am I going to be good in business? Or is God going to help me do this or do that? How am I best going to serve God? And this has the added impact of strengthening my service to God.
Yes.
So I can serve Him in a disinterested way, if you will.
I have
a very good answer to that. As we know, there are 7 billion people in the world. There's 12 million Jews. The Jews in the last 100 years have suffered greatly. So because of that, and the last Nobel Prize winners of the 7 Nobel Prize winners in science, 5 of them were Jewish. That's a perfectly good rationale to me that understands the suffering of love. So the Jews have suffered, so they have found a way to give back to the world by the Nobel Prize winners in science. What's that rationale?
And that could be an interpretation of suffering of love. It's not atonement.
No.
And it's not in order to give the opportunity for disinterested service. It's simply to steal us and test us and improve us. All this could be. The Talmud doesn't define what suffering of love is.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, overall, I think, you know, if you say good things happen, you know, and you're put in certain positions or certain things that from the outside look good, it may be because, I mean, you're following, there's a certain purpose there, and maybe God has set out that certain things are going to be achieved in His purpose, and maybe He's using you as an instrument to carry that out, even and bless you in certain ways, so His purpose will be carried out.
Yeah. Possible.
Giving you good health to continue your Jewish initiative studies.
Okay, let's go on. We're going on after footnote 29. Just where we left off. I'm not skipping anything.
Losing my place.
Rabbi Abba, the son of Rabbi Chiya, Ben Abba said to them, thus said Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, the name Rabbi Yochanan, both of them are chastenings of love. For it is said, whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth. In other words, you said that if you suffer so that you can't daven, that it's not suffering of love. I disagree. You said if you suffer so much you can't learn Torah, it's not suffering love. I disagree. I say no matter how bad the suffering is, even if it prevents you from learning Torah and praying, it's still called suffering of love. This might be just a technical distinction, or it might be an essential distinction. It might be that what we have in front of us reveals that the different parties have two different conceptions of what suffering of love is. If you say that suffering of love is such only when you can still learn and pray, then perhaps that shows us that suffering of love, according to that opinion, is for the purpose of disinterested service of God. The other opinion, Rabbi Yochanan, who says any type of suffering is still suffering of love, then perhaps it's something else, perhaps it's atonement. Could be, right? Could be. And then we read on. Why then does it say, and teacheth him out of the law, right? The verse that talks of suffering of love says the end, and teaches him out of the law. And the other party understood that means that it's called suffering of love only when you can still be taught the law, only when you can still come to class and study. So if Rabbi Yochanan says that it's suffering of love even when you can't teach out of the law, then why is that written in the verse? He's going to have to reinterpret the verse. And what he says is, do not read tilamdenu, but rather tilamdenu. A tiny difference of one vowel. It's the difference between, let me put on the board, tilamdenu or tilamdenu. Difference of one dot. Tilamdenu means teach us. Tilamdenu means teach him or teach it. Right? This is us. No, I'm sorry. It's the opposite.
It's
the opposite.
Them.
This one is teach him and this one is teach us. So if you read it as we traditionally read it, tilamdenu, teach him, so the suffering of love has to be such that you can still teach him, you can still learn Torah. But whereas teach us is going to be a completely different interpretation to say that suffering of love is something that can be taught us. The concept can be taught us from what it's about to say. And it doesn't mean that for suffering of love you have to be in a state that you can be taught, that the person, him, can be taught. It's rather that the suffering of love is taught to us, to the whole Jewish people, through a certain development of the verses that we're about to read, which is rather fascinating. And even if you don't understand all the exegesis, you'll understand the point. Thou teachest us this thing, this matter of suffering of love, out of the law, out of the Torah, as a conclusion, a fortiori, which means all the more so, from the law concerning tooth and eye. Now, what's the law of tooth and eye?
Eye is tach an eye and she tach a she.
Yeah. No, it's the law.
Is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth?
No, that's what Chip just said. It's rather what it says near the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim.
Yeah.
That if you have a slave and you accidentally knock out his eye or his tooth, he goes free. He goes free. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read now. Tooth and eye are only one limb of a man, and still if they are hurt, the slave obtains thereby his freedom. How much more so with painful suffering, which torment the whole body of a man? And all the more so is that, just like in the case of Shein V'ayin, of tooth and eye, if you cause the slave to suffer, he gets his freedom. So all the more so in our case, if you suffer your whole body, you get your freedom. So what's happening here is that in some sense, we're making connection between the idea of suffering of love and suffering that provides freedom. In some sense, there's a connection between suffering and love and a result of freedom.
Well, is that freedom from prayer and learning Torah?
No, because this is the Rabbi Yochanan who says, in other words, you're right. The suffering is such that you can no longer learn.
Wait a second.
You can no longer learn and no longer daven. But that's not the freedom. I hope you're being cynical about it.
No longer a slave to God. You can argue.
Right. The freedom might be that you can now serve God free of self-interest. Right. That's what Moshe Halbertal would say. But of course it could be something else. Atonement also grants freedom. Freedom from the albatross of past sins. And if you think that suffering of love is about building character, we can say it's freedom in the sense that the suffering frees you from your character faults, from your blemishes. So in other words, this word freedom here really doesn't help us because it can be applied to all the different understandings of suffering of love, but it does help us really to see here that in all the different interpretations there is some type of advancement, some type of liberation from shackles. Either being liberated from past sin or you're being liberated from interested service of God, or you're being liberated from your character flaws, but there's a degree here of liberation and freedom. It's rather fascinating to think of it in that sense, that suffering comes to free you from something. And then it's just a matter of free you from what?
Frees you from pleasure.
That's too simple.
So what you're really saying is, like all 99% of the men in B'nai Brak and Meir Shirim have sinned, and therefore they have devoted their life to study.
I don't get it. To overcome
the sins.
We study for the mitzvah of study. What is it related to sin?
Well, there's good and there's bad. There's punishment, there's atonement.
I don't see it. Okay.
I keep thinking of that story that we learned way back somewhere. I can't remember the different rabbis, how maybe it was Rabbi Akiva that comes and says to the other rabbi, you know, you should be happy for this suffering.
Yes, yes.
And then when he himself, whoever the rabbi was, gets sick, he says, you know, I don't want this, you know, forget about all this being good. Just, you know, let me get well and, you know, and I'll sacrifice all the other good stuff.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was a few weeks ago.
Yeah. It sounds good on paper.
Yeah.
And it might even be true. But it's difficult.
But it's human nature.
What is human nature?
To not want to suffer. It's human nature.
I think that there's no denying that.
Right.
I mean, if there's a God and he gives you human nature, ergo, you don't want to suffer.
Right, but I just wanted to mention the difference between a perspective before the fact and a perspective after the fact.
Enduring.
Right, there are so many people, and I'm sure we've encountered them, perhaps even there's someone in the room who falls in this category, who suffered through, let's say, cancer. And after the fact, the person says, I would not want to have lived my life without this. It gave me so much perspective. On the other hand, before the fact, right, you don't push it upon yourself. So after the fact, we're reading all of the benefits. Before the fact, or during the fact, I'd rather not. Joe.
This sounds like it's way off the subject, but there is a connection in my mind. When did we start, the rabbis start talking about along how long? I mean, it's not in the Torah as such. So the rabbis came up with the concept of life after death, and
right.
You know, you want to not do bad things so that you're okay afterwards. When did that concept start?
So that's really an impossible question to answer. It's impossible to answer because Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, was oral for so many generations.
Okay.
And you can't really know when this concept entered into Jewish thought.
Is it Persian influence?
So those who would say that it is an external influence from Persia, and they will try and pinpoint when the concept entered from Persian, from contact with Persia. Others will say that it develops as a response to our issue of theodicy, and they will locate it around the time of the Hadrianic persecutions. Now, we indeed saw in the passages we learned from Tractate Kiddushin in the Babylonian Talmud that the idea of reward in the next world seems to be brought as a ingenious solution to the matter of why do bad things happen to good people. But of course that doesn't mean that the concept was only invented then. It might mean that the concept then was seized upon as a solution to a burning problem, but that not that it didn't exist before that. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I've had cancer twice.
Say it again?
I've had cancer twice.
Uh-huh.
And I don't see any benefit from having cancer myself.
Okay. Yeah.
Question, and I know it's off topic, but it's, as you're talking, it's kind of bothering me. If a person develops something like Alzheimer's, okay, they don't know that they're sick. They aren't able to study.
Right.
They don't technically suffer, but the people around them suffer because they're like la la land. Is that God's intervention to this person? Is it a punishment? Is it not a punishment? How would the rabbis interpret an illness like Alzheimer's? You're no longer, you're totally unable to study. You have really no capacity anymore.
Alzheimer's when it's serious, right,
what?
Is really death while the body is still alive.
Right.
Dorothy, you know I don't have answers to questions like that. Don't
no,
you know me?
It's all part of this, though, because, you know, suffering of love, you're still able to study.
Right, that's what we're talking about.
I mean, you could be hurting, but you're still able to take some time of your death. But
right.
You're totally, you know, incapacitated, you know, and you can't say that everyone who gets Alzheimer's has been evil.
Yeah, Alzheimer's is like death. That's why do good people die? That's our question, right? That's what we're struggling with. And this matter of atonement, right, for the next world, you can say that also for Alzheimer's.
Well, I think it's very disappointing because I don't think we're going to find the answer in this class. And I thought when I sat down here we were going to come to some conclusion.
Joe, I'm sorry to have disappointed you.
But no, suffering does bring you to recognize suffering around you. And our society has decided that we are going to find ways to stop the suffering, resolve the suffering, and we have made great, great progress on it. And without recognizing that suffering, you know, you look upon, you are talking about an example of the suffering of love, you look upon the AIDS epidemic that happened around the world, and you look upon the great, you know, the great effort that society in the United States has made in finding cures for that and stopping that. I think what the world, instead of ignoring it,
yeah,
as we used to do when you had typhus or tuberculosis, whatever. We've learned to gather efforts and take care of that suffering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't see what's the matter with that. Why should now?
I wonder if we shouldn't turn it around a little. Why do good things happen to bad people?
It's part of the same question. Right? Yeah. Okay, let's read on in this text. And this agrees, right, with the saying of Rabbi Shimon bar Lakish. This is the rabbi who's also called Reish Lakish. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Shimon bar Lakish said, the word covenant is mentioned in connection with salt, and the word covenant is mentioned in connection with suffering. The word covenant is mentioned in connection with salt, as it is written, neither shall thou suffer the salt of the covenant of thy God to be lacking. And now the next four lines, I think, have been inadvertently omitted from your text. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just read it to you. Mm-hmm. And the word covenant is mentioned in connection with suffering. As it is written, these are the words of the covenant. Even as in the covenant mentioned in connection with salt, the salt lends a sweet taste to the meat. In other words, a spice, not salt, not sweet,
sweet.
And a spice to the meat. So also in connection, the covenant mentioned in connection with suffering, the suffering wash away all the sins of a man. I'm sorry that I'm going to confuse you here. This is confusing.
It all is.
It says that there's a connection between the two covenants, the covenant of suffering and the covenant of salt. What's the connection? Just like salt lends a spicy taste to the meat, so also in the case of suffering, it washes away the sins of man. This doesn't make any sense. The symmetry is lost. What I'm trying to say is the text is faulty.
Oh,
and we don't know the true text. I'm going to try and do some homework. I don't have here in Dallas any manuscripts to check this out. But I'm going to try and do some homework.
I think that there's some consistency there, because they're saying that in one case you're getting rid of sin, which is good. You want it to happen to you. In the other case, you're eating meat and you're enhancing the flavor, which
right.
is good that you're trying to do.
Right. Joe's right. Those who accept the text as we have it will say what Joe said. And what Joe said, if we take it at face value, take the text at face value, it means that it actually says here, black and white, what suffering of love is. It washes away the sins of man. As we said, that in this whole passage talking about suffering of love, it's not clear what the suffering of love is. Perhaps it's the atonement matter. Perhaps it's the possibility, the opportunity of disinterested service of God. Perhaps it's the matter of the uplifting and refining of character. It's not clear. It's something proactive. It's not reactive. But what is it? It's not clear. Here, if we take the text as it is, it says clearly what we're talking about. Washing away the sins of men, meaning atonement. Again, it's not punishment for the sins. It's washing them away, getting rid of them. That's what suffering of love is. So if we take the text at face value, then we can't accept anything but this one interpretation of suffering of love. But I hope to come back to you next week with other texts.
But the salt interests me, because in North Africa, Jews live next to the Sultan's palace, and it's called the Melach. It's salt.
Uh-huh.
No one is really certain. Some think it's because they had to salt the heads before they were put on spikes. But Jews are connected with Melach in North Africa.
Okay, I have no
it's
idea.
Salt.
I have no idea.
You know?
Yeah. I want to try and go on.
Yeah.
It has been taught, and now you have the text. Here, it's a new paragraph, it should be.
What?
It has been taught, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says. This is just where we left off.
Oh,
yeah.
Again, it's a new paragraph.
Oh, okay. I kind of recited it.
It should be a new paragraph.
Yeah.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, the Holy One, blessed be He, gave Israel three precious gifts, and all of them were given only through suffering. These are the Torah, the land of Israel, and the world to come. And we don't have to read the sources that he brings from the verses. But all of these three things, these three good things, come only through suffering. Now let's think about this for a moment. If this statement is brought in the context of our discussion and suffering of love, it means, here's another example of suffering of love, that you suffer and you get these three things, the Torah, the land of Israel, and the world to come. Ah, if we're focusing on the world to come, well, what do you mean, through suffering get the world to come? Well, that's atonement. On the other hand, if you get the Torah, the land of Israel, through suffering, that's saying that suffering is a vehicle that brings us benefit in the future.
That's atonement also.
That's it.
Atonement also. Benefit.
Atonement? I guess it could be. You're right. You could be. The point is that these Talmudic passages, this one especially, but many of them, really do not define what they're talking about in suffering of love. All we know, it's some type of benefit. It's not reactive, it's proactive, but we don't really know more than that. Let's go on. A Tanna recited before Rabbi Yochanan the following: if a man busies himself in the study of Torah and the acts of charity and buries his children, right? Yeah. If you do good things, but you suffer, all his sins are forgiven him. It looks again like this matter of suffering of love is about atonement, right? There's a very, very strong indications in this passage that it's just about atonement and it's not anything beyond that. It's what I called earlier the minimalistic understanding. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, I grant you Torah and acts of charity. And he brings verses. But then he says, and I'm skipping a few lines, but how do you know what you say about the one who buries his children? And I understand that if you do good deeds, then that causes sins to be forgiven. But what you tell me, that suffering, that you lose your children, that causes one's sins to be forgiven, I want you to prove that to me. And Rabbi Yochanan seems to be a little bit reticent, hesitant about this idea that suffering causes sins to be forgiven.
But he's the same guy who didn't want suffering.
He's the same guy that didn't want suffering, and he's the same guy, as we're about to see, who lost 10 children in his lifetime. So I just want us to see that there is here a struggle among the rabbis in defining this concept of suffering of love. Let's go on to the next paragraph. And this one brings us something fantastic. Fantastic. Rabbi Yochanan says, bodily suffering and the lack of children are not chastisements of love. Now, Rabbi Yochanan was the same one who said earlier, if I'm not mistaken, that if you lose the opportunity to study and lose the opportunity to pray, it's still suffering of love. But if it's bodily suffering and lack of children are not suffering of love, how do you drive that? I'm not sure. But look what we get right now. But is bodily suffering not a trustpoint of love? Of course it is. Is it not taught, if a man has one of these four symptoms of bodily suffering, it is nothing else but an altar of atonement? Answer: they are an altar of atonement, but they are not chastisements of love. We're going to spend 5 minutes on that. I'll explain what we just read. So I'll say it outside. Rabbi Yochanan said that suffering and losing your children is not suffering of love. The Talmud says it certainly is suffering of love, and I'll bring you a proof, because we have this famous statement that says that if one has four symptoms of bodily suffering, it's nothing but an altar of atonement. Which, of course, is assuming that altar of atonement and suffering of love is the same thing. The answer is, they're an altar of atonement, but they're not suffering of love. In other words, they're two different things. Did you get what I just said? So now, say here we finally see a little bit of a focus on exactly what this matter of suffering of love is. Because the Talmud thought that suffering love and altar of atonement are the same thing. The answer is, there's two different things. So here we finally have what we've been waiting for the past hour. We see that it just might be that there are two separate concepts. One is called atonement, the other is called suffering of love. Now, the Talmud thought they're the same thing. It answers that they're not. And now we'll see that that answer is only one of many answers, which means that some hold that they are the same thing. Somehow they aren't. So here we finally have it. We really have the rabbis grappling with the idea, is suffering of love, is it merely atonement, or perhaps it's something else? And if it's something else, well, then we have to ask what it is. And that brings us back to the two other possibilities we had on the table earlier. One is what Moshe Halbertal said, it's an opportunity for disinterested service of God. The other is what we've said for many classes, Jim mentioned earlier, I think it's an opportunity for self-improvement, for refinement of the personality. But I'm very excited by this line, right? Because we really see the possibility of further defining what suffering of love and perhaps divorcing it from the concept of atonement, which to me is an advancement. But I said I tried to bring these Talmudic passages in a certain order, and it's hard to find an order for all these different concepts. But this I would call one step forward in our search for meaning of why do bad things happen to good people.
But he doesn't give an answer of what it is. He just says they're different.
Just says that they're different. And you're right. And then we have to...
then we have to figure out
what it is. But
as he doesn't figure it out different.
We don't have to figure it out.
He makes a statement that they're different.
Right.
But
yeah.
He should give you...
No.
Why they're different and how they're different. He doesn't go into that, at least not in this paragraph.
No, you need to go to a different rabbi to understand that.
Yeah, but what's the value of saying that it's different if he doesn't then discuss what it is?
Then it's up to you or another rabbi to tell you how they're different.
We'll come to more sources.
Right.
Okay, let's try and read on. Okay. Oh, goodness gracious. Let's try and read on a little bit. Next paragraph, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba fell ill. And Rabbi Yochanan went in to visit him. Okay, you with me?
Yes.
He said to him, are your sufferings welcome to you? Do you accept them? He replied, neither they nor their reward. Mm-hmm. He said to him, give me your hand. He gave him his hand and he raised him. Call it miraculous, call it psychology, whatever it is, he managed to cure him. But the point is, and this goes back to something Chip said an hour ago, and this is in a source we also saw 2 weeks ago. The point is that if the suffering is welcome, if you're willing to utilize it for its purpose, then it's worthwhile. If not, then you might as well go to the doctor and get rid of it. And that brings us again back to Moshe Halbertal. If you're able to use the suffering to embrace it, accept it, if it's welcome, use it as an opportunity for disinterested service of God, if you're able to do that, then it's good to keep suffering. It really is. It's an opportunity. Why would I want to get rid of it? But if it's not welcome to you, if you can't use it as an opportunity, then you might as well go to the doctor and get rid of it. That's kind of what happens.
So this person's not welcome. It's not welcome to him.
No, not welcome.
So
Rabbi Yochanan says, I'll cure you then.
Rabbi Yochanan just cures
them. And the implication is that Rabbi Yochanan has the ability to cure. I don't know where that comes from, doesn't matter. Has the ability to cure. But he wouldn't have cured if he saw that the cure wasn't necessary. Because if the suffering was welcome and it was serving a positive purpose, then why get rid of it?
Then the cure would be worse than the disease.
The cure would be worse than the disease. Rabbi Yochanan once fell ill, and Rabbi Chanina went in to visit him. He said to him, are your sufferings welcome to you? He replied, neither they nor their reward. He said to him, give me your hand. He gave him his hand and he raised him. Same thing again. But the Talmud asked, why could not Rabbi Yochanan raise himself? They replied, the prisoner cannot free himself from jail. Whatever, not clear, it doesn't matter. Rabbi Elazar fell ill, and Rabbi Yochanan went to visit him. He noticed that he was lying in a dark room, and he bared his arm, and light radiated from it. That's part of the Agadah, that Rabbi Yochanan was the most handsome man in the world, and light radiated from his beautiful body. Thereupon he noticed Rabbi Elazar was weeping, and he said to him, "Why do you weep? Is it because you did not study enough Torah? Are you sorry? You're about to die. Are you sorry that you didn't utilize your life to the hilt? You didn't learn as much Torah as you could?" "Don't weep about that, because surely we learnt the one the one who sacrifices much and the one who sacrifices little have the same merit, provided that the heart is directed to heaven." In other words, the quantity doesn't matter, it's the quality. And we know that you had the best quality. "Is it because of a lack of sustenance? Are you crying because you were poor all your life? Not everyone has the privilege to enjoy two tables. You have the spirituality, you'll have Olam Haba. You didn't have this world, don't cry about it. Is it because of the lack of children, that you had no children in your lifetime?" Rabbi Yochanan said, "This is the bone of my 10th son." He took out of his pocket the bone of his 10th son. He lost all his children in his lifetime.
Well,
said to Rabbi Eliezer,
bury the whole body.
He said to Rabbi Eliezer, "Don't cry for not having children. I had 10, I lost them all." He replied to him, "I am weeping on account of this beauty that is going to rot in the earth." He said to him, "On that account you surely have reason to weep." And they both wept. Now there's Rabbi Elazar, seeing Rabbi Yochanan's beauty, wept. And Rabbi Yochanan said, "That's a good reason to cry." And they both started crying. Now this is so powerful, because in all of the passages we've been learning, including this one right here, we're searching for a meaning of suffering, a meaning for death. There's something good in it. And ultimately, says Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar, you know what? Life is better than death. Which also means that health is better than suffering.
We're supposed to choose life.
Choose life. We can find all these explanations. And after the fact, they make some sense. But as far as ultimate values go, we're never going to reach that level that certain Christian sects have reached, which a funeral is an occasion for rejoicing, because you're going to the next world, a better world. No. Death is a reason to weep. And suffering is something to be overcome, as we saw Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chanina, with the opportunity. They'll give up the suffering and its reward and choose life and choose health. In the meanwhile, he said to him, "Are your sufferings welcome to you?" And of course, the answer is, neither they nor their reward. He said to him, "Give me your hand," and he gave him his hand, and he raised him. And I think that's really a wonderful way to end. That again, we're coming back to the idea, with all the explanations, ultimately, there is not a higher value in suffering than in health, and there's not a higher value in death than in life.
What about carrying around a bone when you're supposed to bury the whole body?
It's a story.
I know, but what did Rabbi say about that?
So you're right, Stephanie. You're right, Stephanie.
I've seen Orthodox rabbis roll up their white sleeves and start with tweezers on Ben Yehuda, looking for every iota after a suicide bomb attack. Yeah. And this man, what do they say about him carrying around a bone? It's a bone of contention to me.
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. Okay.
God help everyone who comes to me and says, "Are you welcome?"